climate change and indigenous peoples on the front lines. We are privileged to have three speakers who come at these issues from different angles with different experiences, but all of which are extremely rich and I think will give us still, of course, just a hint of the diversity of these topics and these linkages, but ones that are really very rich in terms of where we're going, in terms of challenging. Sorry, as we're juggling computers here. So I'm going to be shut up because we want to hear from these folks. We don't have a lot of time. We're going to hear first from Margaret Hizza Redsteer, who's a research scientist based at the Flagstaff Science Center and the U.S. Geological Survey, who has been working on climate change and impacts in native lands here in the lower 48. Then we'll hear from Sarah James, who's a board member and spokesperson with the Nitsai Gwich'in. Hopefully I have that correct. Apologies, Sarah, if I don't. The Arctic Village. And so, Sarah, welcome. I know you had about five legs of a flight and took enough time so you could have gotten to the other side. You could have gotten to Asia as long as it took you to fly here. So we thank you very, very much for all those plane switches to join us. Thank you very, very much. And then Scott Wallace, although his commute this time was shorter, is going to tell us about quite a trip as well. His multiple months in the western Amazonia near the Peruvian border, but in Brazil, accompanying Carlos Pozuelo from FUNAI, the government's body that looks at the uncontacted tribes in Brazil, and talk about his new book, The Unconquered, and some of the lessons he learned from there and how those connect to questions of climate change as well. So, Margaret, I've pulled up your slides, and if I'm happy to be the one to advance if you'd like, or I'm also happy to have you sit here, whichever you prefer. So you can see them. Actually, you need to be able to see them.
Maybe I need to see them.
Yeah. Well, she's just moving. Just a reminder, what we will do, like the others, is the kind of quick staccato and embarrassingly short amount of time for these experts to talk with five-minute presentations each, and then we'll have a Q&A. We ask that a kind of a reminder to our panelists, because we have some folks who are recording this for radio, if you can be sure to be close to the mic so that can be picked up. And then when we come to the Q&A, I or the questioner will repeat the question into the mic so that we have that as well. So, Margaret, please.
No, that's fine right there. Hello, my name is Margaret Hizza Redsteer, as I was greatly introduced already. So I guess the first thing to mention is where I work. I work in northeastern Arizona primarily, although I'm also involved in writing a chapter in the National Climate Assessment on climate change impacts to the tribes in the Southwest in general. I work in an area that most of you have probably seen in either City Slickers or John Wayne Westerns. It's a large area about the size of West Virginia, and one of the important features of it is that it has two seasons, two wet seasons. One is the winter snow and then the summer monsoon. Right now, the Navajo Nation has been facing a drought that started in about 1994. The official records say that it started in 1999, but we have some information, meteorological data, that points to the fact that the drought started in a more arid part of the Navajo Nation much earlier than the rest of Arizona. And drought on the Navajo Nation means no water. That's what it means to a lot of people. 50% of the population don't have electricity or running water. And the picture that you see on the upper right is Locus Acad Spring. And people are hauling water from that spring in this picture. It's one of the springs that we tested the water quality of. And you would never, ever see this kind of picture today. Because what happens today is people come to this spring at midnight. and they start lining up at midnight to get their water because by that time, the spring has begun to recharge because the water flow is so low. So people come to the spring at midnight, and they line up, and then by the time the sun comes up, there's no water left. And so people who are at the end of the line who don't get there early enough, they don't get any drinking water from there, and they're forced to look at for other springs where they might be able to get drinking water. And part of the reason also that this spring is beginning to be overutilized is because so many of the other springs have already gone dry that people used to rely on for water. So they come to this spring now, and other people will recognize people who aren't from their area. And it's getting to the point where actually people get their guns out and fight over their water resources. It's one of the things we've learned from our water hauling study this summer was that there are more and more conflicts over water sources because of the dwindling water supply. If these people were to go to Tuba City or Kayenta, the communities or Navajo municipalities, they would get turned away simply because the municipalities don't have enough water to handle the demand. So how did I end up doing this? Well, I lived on the Navajo Nation as a young mother and raised my children there and always heard stories about how much grass there was, how there used to be a lot of rainfall and those kinds of things. And didn't really register in my mind until much later as a research scientist when I began to tackle the ideas of climate change. And one of the first things I looked at was the mobility of sand dunes because they're very sensitive to climate change. The more mobile they are, the higher the wind speeds are and the drier it is. So it's a very close relationship to climatic variables, the amount of sand that you see moving. But there are also a lot of data gaps. We were looking at archived aerial photos, satellite imagery, historic scientific documents, old USGS professional papers to try to get a history of how the environment has changed with climate change on the Navajo Nation. So one of the other things we did was start recording the accounts of tribal elders and I have the results tabulated for the interviews of 73 tribal elders, but we have close to 100 interviews now. And part of the reason for doing that is we want a more comprehensive regional view of how things have changed. And one of the things that was very stark is in individual interviews with all of these different people, they all said that there's less snow and rain, and particularly less snow now than there used to be. But there are other environmental conditions that they noted, and here's just a short list of some of the things that they mention. They tell us a lot more about the environmental conditions and how much the environmental conditions have changed. This is the kind of information you can't get from old scientific documents or from weather station records. For instance, one of the things that was really striking to me is that before the early 1940s, the ground stayed moist until the 4th of July. And as I mentioned to you, there's two wet seasons on the Navajo Nation. There's the winter snow and then the summer monsoon. And in between, there's a very dry, windy spring. So under current conditions right now, you can dig at the end of, before the monsoon arrives, and at the end of June, you can dig a 6-foot pit and you're not going to find any wet sand in there. You're not going to find any moisture. But earlier on in the 20th century, actually there was enough moisture in the ground from winter precipitation that the ground stayed moist until the summer monsoon arrived. That's a huge environmental change that you can't really obtain from looking at meteorological records. I could calculate, you know, what type of soil moisture balances there should be until I'm blue in the face, but I would never be certain that these were the actual conditions. So these are important things. Also, because of the disappearance of surface water features, beavers, cranes, egrets, a lot of animals that depend on having that surface water, those surface water features there are now gone. So these are things, other things that the elders noted, as well as the disappearance of traditional food source plants and medicinal plants. So just to give you an idea of how the physical data looks compared to what we learned from the tribal elders, this is a graph of the trends in snowfall from 1931 to 2009 on the Navajo Nation. The years are across the horizontal axis on the bottom, and then the depth of snow in millimeters is on the vertical axis. And this is averaged from 25 stations across the Navajo Nation because we wanted to get an idea of what the regional changes were rather than just the fluctuations in one spot. One of the things to note here is that the snowpack has gotten so small in recent years that it's really almost nothing. And the reason that 1975 is pointed to is that's the year that a lot of elders said that there wasn't enough surface water left to even irrigate for farming. So, you know, that's another thing that's gone from the Navajo tribe is the ability to grow corn and other crops, which was a big part of Navajo culture, even in pre-Columbian times. So as a result of this changing snowpack, we also have a result in a decline in perennial flow. The yellow areas on here denote where there was stream flow all year round that was characterized by, it was noted in a USGS professional paper that was published in 1917 by Herbert Gregory. And then by the time the next water resource study came along in the 50s and 60s, they noted perennial flow in the green areas. And now the only place where there's perennial flow is clear over on the left-hand side of the picture. You'll see a tiny little black line. That's from Blue Spring down to the confluence of the Colorado River. That's the only place in the Navajo Nation where there's perennial stream flow today. Downwind from these perennial stream flow, where there used to be perennial flow, we now have dry riverbeds. So in the springtime, when there's no more water in the streams and it gets very windy, we have a lot of sand that blows out of those stream beds. At the very top right-hand corner, there's a little part of that wash, Chisto Wash, showing in the picture. This is a long road into some houses for an extended family. And you'll notice that they have to cross a lot of sand dunes to get to their houses. And then if you look at the bottom of the picture, you also see a big train of sand dunes that are headed towards their houses. Those sand dunes are moving at a rate of about 150 feet per year. And some of the structures there are already covered. Right next to the road, there's an outhouse. That outhouse is already under a sand dune. So we've been trying to do what we can to change. I'm just going to move really quickly through here because I think I'm taking up too much time. To try to combat some of this. So one of the things we've done is we've organized the high school kids from all around the reservation, and we're making mud balls out of native grass seeds that we are distributing across the sand dunes. This is a group of high school students doing that. And then I also had some visiting scientists from the Gobi Desert come and look at what we could do to stabilize the sand dunes. And they, as a gift, provided this material to us. It's polylactic acid hoses that we fill with sand. It's a corn fiber-based material, so it biodegrades. So we're hoping that we can get a handle on at least some of the sand dune problems that we have with people losing their homes. But quite frankly, at this point, it's a little bit like holding a thimble over your head and trying to stay dry in a downpour. The changes that are taking place right now are so widespread, and the communities that are facing problems with blowing sand and dust, problems with lack of municipal drinking water, domestic water supplies are really overwhelming in many ways. And there are Navajo tribal officials that I've talked to who've just you know, flatly stated that there are places on the Navajo Nation that will just become uninhabitable in the next 5 to 10 years, and that they're going to have to do what they can to save the communities they feel that are possible to save. And that's the conditions that we're facing now. And because of the way we've been able to document the changes in the amount of moisture available, the rising temperatures and decreasing snowfall, we know that many of these effects, although they are partly exacerbated by land use practices, are also climatic effects. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret. We're going to turn straight away to Sarah James. And Sarah, please. The floor is yours.
I say we came a long ways. We still have a long ways to go together yet. I'm here on behalf of Gujjar Nation elders that cannot be here today, and children that's not yet born, and so we can have a better, a nicer earth to live on. And I hope my message is a good one. And first of all, I would like to, on behalf of Gujjar Nation, I'd like to thank S.E.J. for inviting me here on this board, and Scott Wallace here, and everybody that made it possible for me to speak here. I'm from Arctic Village, Alaska. Arctic Village is like 110 miles northeast of Arctic Circle, interior, and by the river is Yukon, and then you go up in Chandler, and then east of Chandler is where the Arctic Village is at. It's the south boundary of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and there's about 150 people live in Arctic Village, and there is no running water, and we hunt and fish, and most of our diet is about 75% of our diet is still wild meat from the land, and most of it is caribou, moose, fish, and birds and ducks and small animals, and the other Western food we can combine with. Our children learn. We have K-12 school, and we learn, and I got caught in that, and our kids too, that we have to live in our traditional way. We and teach our children saying, go back to the land, take care of the land, this is our way, and we're the steward of the land, and respect your elders. At the same time, we tell them to go out into the world and get your higher education in so you have a good job. So we caught in two different worlds, and we have to learn. We try to direct our next generation into the future with good tools from each end. We love to go back to the bow and arrow days, but we can't, and we can't be somebody's we cannot be. So that's how it is for my people. Back in 1988, my people took a position against that oil and gas development of the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Gujjar live northeast Alaska and North Yukon Territory and Mackenzie Delta of Northwest Territory. And there's 15 villages and there's 8,000 of us. At that time, the elders called a gather together in Arctic Village, June 1988. We took a position against our oil and gas development. It was really hard decision for our elders and our leaders and our youth, because that means we had to take a political position, because it's up to the Congress to make that decision. And we have been doing good because the elders gave us a direction to do it in a good way. And we have been, and we made many friends because they also told us that we cannot do it by ourselves. So we have made many friends throughout the nation. We overcame many, many battles since 1988, along with our friends. And still is a big-time threat right now in the Congress today because of the jobs, which is not going to provide, because of the energy, which is not going to provide for our nation. There's not enough there. So we really need facts out there told about Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from the journals. And I'm really honored to be here, able to speak for my people. We call that place Ishikutsan Kontaikotlit. That means sacred place where the life begin. It's not only for the caribou. Porcupine River caribou is for many birds and ducks that fly from all over the world to nest there every year. And it's also for three species of bears still exist there, which is polar bears, which is threatened by climate change, and grizzly bears, and a black bear. So it's a very special place that needs to be kept protected and permanently protected. Only one-tenth of the Arctic coast is protected, which is coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the rest is into development or will be. So that's how threatened it is. We took that position back in 1988 because a lot of our elders and leaders were talking about global warming, climate change, the hole in the ozone, all that stuff that's coming, is coming, and it's here, and it's really here in our, in the Arctic. Climate change and global warming is real in the Arctic. It's very real. And people that live close to the land, the animal that lives on the land, are threatened big time in Alaska, where I'm from. It's neither come by heat waves or cold spill. Even we don't even know kind of whether we're going to get every day. It's like a norm to get whatever weather is going to, we're going to get every day today. A lot of erosion, a lot of drought, a lot of forest fire, and there's five villages throughout Alaska. It's been eroded away, have to move. Very expensive. As a media, I'd like to invite everybody up to Arctic Village. I'd like you to, if you see me out there in the hallway, be sure and talk to me, and because I got a story to tell, because up there in Alaska, where I'm from, it's real and it's natural. The ecosystem still works. It doesn't need restoration. It doesn't need to get cleaned up. It doesn't need to replace anything. It's still good. We have chance to save what is there, still there. And we need to come together and tell the truth about places like that, which is Coastal Plain, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for my people. And it's a, it is a national issue. It's a national environmental issue. It's a national human rights issue, because we always been there. We never came from nowhere. We always, God put us there, and we're there to stay. And that's our responsibility, to stay there. So later on, I think in our way, giving thanks and giving opening and all that will come along with my drum here later at the end of the session. Thank you for listening to me, and come to Arctic Village, come to Alaska, come to any of the Gwich'in village. There's 15 villages throughout the Gwich'in nation, even though the border is between us and Canadian U.S. border. We don't see border. Caribou don't see border. Caribou don't see no natural border between the coastal plain and the mountains or the rivers or anywhere. They just need to go to have their calf at the coastal plain, the Porcupine River caribou, and that needs to be safe forever. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. We look forward to closing today's session with a song of prayer from you. Thank you so much for sharing that with us in advance. We'll turn now to Scott Wallace.
Hi, everyone. Is this working? Yeah? It's humbling to be here flanked by two such great people and recognizing that I myself am not an indigenous person. But I have spent quite a lot of time with indigenous populations, indigenous people, as a journalist, and I can attest to what Sarah says. It is an amazing experience to go and be among the Gwich'in in Alaska. I've been there twice, and it's really worth doing. It's an incredible struggle and a great story, and they're wonderful people. And the nature of Alaska is just phenomenally stunning. So I highly recommend that. I'm going to begin talking about the Amazon today with I'm going to show you a trailer for my book that's just been released this week called The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. And I'll let the trailer run first and then talk about it.
Hopefully the volume, I just want to make sure. No, I don't want to need it. It may just only be for the computer.
Now, if you drag the slider next to the pause button there, the audio to.
Okay, if I drag this to here.
Yeah, start there. Raise that volume button just to the right of that. You see the blue? Drag that all the way over to that.
Okay. I think it'll still only be here rather than on those speakers.
Can you use my mic to your computer?
We can try that.
Well, you know.
Really high quality sound.
São vários os objetivos, mas os principais é, primeiro, dimensionar a terra efetivamente ocupada por esses povos isolados.
Perder e nada a ganhar. Não tem nada a ganhar.
Okay, so The Unconquered is the book that I just published, but I want to talk a little bit about the situation in the Amazon and how it's impacting indigenous people and the wider implications for all of us about how what's going on with the Amazon today. We now know that through pretty recent demographic studies that the Amazon, like large parts of the Americas were actually much more densely populated at the time of the first European colonizers than was previously known. The Amazon itself had millions of indigenous people living there at the time of the first explorations by European conquistadors. Massive die-offs ensued from the first penetrations of Spaniards into and Portuguese into the Amazon. But the rainforest itself survived and survived intact pretty much until the last few years. In the last 50 to 60 years, with a period that basically coincides with the advent of the chainsaw and the bulldozer, more of the Amazon has been deforested than in the previous 450 years combined since the first European colonization of the Amazon. The impacts of climate have been pretty severe. In recent years, we've seen killer droughts spreading in the Amazon. With deforestation comes, we now know that the Amazon produces half of its own rainfall, which is like an incredible phenomenon. As winds take moisture west across the Amazon, it falls and then rises back through transpiration and evaporation into the atmosphere and falls again further west and so on all the way to the Andes. These trends are now being disrupted. Climatologists believe that warming in the North Atlantic is actually contributing to drying out the desiccation of the Amazon. There have been killer droughts, first in 2005, which scientists described as a once-in-a-hundred-year event, and then the same conditions returned 5 years later in 2010. Hundreds of millions of trees have died in the Amazon, and they are now releasing the death of trees from drought and the fires that are so well known now, such iconic images of the Amazon in flames and burning as a result of agricultural conversion of Amazonian land from forest to agriculture, has now made the Amazon a rather than a net sink for carbon, a actual producer of greenhouse gases. I think it's like a fifth of all greenhouse gases now are estimated to come from forest clearing. In any case, the area that I was in the far western corner of Brazil on this trip, my book is about a three-month journey into the land of an uncontacted tribe in the Javari Valley of far western Brazil. This is a vast wilderness area, protected land, indigenous land, roughly half the size of Florida, about the size of Portugal. Within the Javari's boundaries, there are six contacted groups of Indians in various stages of acculturation, what they call acculturation, integration, or contact with the outside society. But also within the Javari, there are eight and possibly more, actually one was just discovered earlier this year, uncontacted groups. When I say discovered, that was that one group was just noticed by aerial reconnaissance this year for the first time. I followed Brazil's Department of Isolated Indians, which is a subgroup of FUNAI, its Indian Affairs Agency. I followed the Department of Isolated Indians on this expedition through the land of a mysterious group known as the People of the Arrow, the Flecheiros. Nobody knows what they call themselves. There's never been peaceful contact with this group. The extraordinary thing about this story, I mean, it's an amazing tale, but one of the things as far as this conference is concerned that I think is really interesting is that Brazil's Department of Isolated Indians, which was founded by the main character in my book, Sidney Pozuelo, has, by virtue of their mandate to protect the regions where the last uncontacted tribes hold forth and actually protect them from intruders, means that they are protecting hundreds, thousands of square miles of virgin rainforest, primeval forest. The Department of Isolated Indians in Brazil actually has jurisdiction over an area roughly the size of New York State, 50,000 square miles, which are off limits to outsiders because the natives who live on that land are being protected and live within that area. So the protection of their human rights, of their right to self-determination, because they have made it clear that they are they prefer to live in isolation from the rest of the world. And in some cases, as we found out on our journey, the Aero people are thriving in isolation in this bastion called the Javari Valley. The question of it's clear that there's a willful determination, self-determination to be left alone, and the way that that is done is by protecting the land that they live on. The department does not make contact with these groups. We went in there to check on their relative well-being, to check for any imminent threats from possible intruders, loggers, poachers, gold prospectors. The mission was not to make contact, but it's a rather quixotic and paradoxical kind of enterprise, because there's the risk that it will occur. But it's only through these kinds of expeditions under the canopy, because it's really thick jungle, that those kind of determinations can be made. And so we were traveling through the land of the Aero people. They had no reason to see us as anything other than hostile intruders. We were, a menace to them as far as they knew, but we did not pursue them, but still we were in their land. So you had this strange situation where they had no idea what we were doing there, and we had no way of explaining to them what we were doing there. And so there was the risk of a possible attack from them. But the department does this kind of work in order to prove that there are people occupying that land, which is absolutely essential to be able to document and prove that in order to get the legal protections and to politically get the support to continue these programs in Brasilia and in the rest of the world, because the department also is funded in part by contributions from the European Union and some international foundations. So I think as far as climate change is concerned in these areas, one of the things that I'm quite alarmed by is, despite the fact that Brazil has in place these very interesting programs and an institutional framework for actually protecting these groups, and Peru now with its new government has indicated a willingness to do something similar and even follow the Brazil model in terms of protecting its indigenous populations in isolation, that climate change may in fact end up undoing all of this, because we know that in the western Amazon, the forests are drying out. There have been wildfires, blistering droughts, wildfires that have never been seen before in the Amazon. And the area where a lot of these groups are continue to hold forth, which is almost exclusively in the western Amazon, in the area between the Andes and the lowlands of the Amazon jungle, these areas are susceptible to climate change, drying out, wildfires, and potentially to degraded, their forests are vulnerable to degradation, and in some cases may actually be, end up being converted in the next 50 years or so by these continual cycles of drought into savannas. And it would be, the tragedy is multiple. These are forests that are the most biodiverse areas in the world. The wildlife that we saw on our trip was absolutely spectacular. The species diversification there is unbelievable. Somewhere around 250 species, 250 trees per acre in any tract of Amazonian forest, western Amazonian forest, 80 different species of trees. Untold numbers of species that are probably yet to be described by science in the area that we were in, and it is all under threat from climate change. So I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Uh,
Thank you very much, Scott, and thanks to all three of you. I will say I'm not quite through the book yet, but I see it as a good sign when somebody misses their metro stop by five stops because you're so engrossed in the book, which is I did with Scott's book. It's a good sign. It's quite a tale, one that's both informative and enthralling. So let's open it up for questions. Just a couple reminders. We want you to keep it short so we can maximize the number of questions. We'll also then maybe take a couple and then let our panel kind of divide them up. And then either I or perhaps better all of you restate the question so the folks on the recording for radio have that. So, sir, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I'd like to, Scott, if you could especially, but if the other two could also address this, tell us what your thoughts are on tourism in indigenous areas. I know some of that has gone out in the Amazon, and I know elsewhere in the world, I know Amazon especially, they're starting to bring in these sort of ecological tours and things like that. What is the, I guess, is there a benefit to that, or is there in the long run versus the short run? If you could just address how tourism is affected.
Okay, Scott, can we take just a couple first, and then we'll
sure.
give you, if there are other questions, sir?
Scott, and found that the protections for national parks and protected lands were feeble at best. We found dozens of illegal logging operations in protected lands. How robust is Brazil's protection in this area, and how much are they putting into that?
And I neglected as chair to remind you all to identify yourselves when you're posing a question.
My name is Michael Coates. I'm an author and photojournalist.
Thank you, Michael.
And I'm Roger Archibald with the SEJ.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you very much. Ma'am, in the back, and then we'll give
Hi, hello, with CTV News. This is a particular for Sarah James. I was just wondering if you could tell us what perhaps is some one or maybe several of the things that you wish that you could share with the younger generation that climate change has changed, that has made a change and made it no longer possible. What kind of regrets of those things would you, things that you would really like the younger generation to see they can no longer see?
Scott, do you want to lead off and restate the questions if you could?
Okay, thank you. The first question has to do with thoughts about tourism in indigenous areas and whether that's beneficial or detrimental. And I would have to say it depends on what kind of tourism it is. On the one hand, I know that some indigenous groups have been very successful in creating an infrastructure and inviting guests to come and see their villages, to see their way of life, to see the spectacular flora and fauna in their lands. And I think that is totally laudable and, in fact, presents an interesting alternative for generating income in communities, alternatives to, you know, the destructive and extractive industries of logging and mining or leasing their land for oil and gas exploration. There's the other type of tourism, basically, which is kind of a parasitic one, I think, where, you know, agencies describe themselves as extreme travel adventure groups, and they take people into the lands where there are isolated tribes. And I see that as basically an invasive and ultimately dangerous sort of enterprise. One thing I didn't mention, the fact that these groups in many instances have no immunity to the germs that we carry. They are still that isolated. And so any potential for contact is ultimately extremely dangerous for the tourists and for the tribal people living there. Thanks. Did anyone else want to respond to that?
Well, I think that would be good, too. Perhaps first you could respond to the other level of enforcement.
Ah, yes. Yeah, sorry. Thank you. And thanks for that question, which had to do with how robust is the protection of some of these areas in Brazil. And the questioner noted that in many areas it seems to be fairly weak in some of the other countries. And I think it's a problem everywhere, not only in the Amazon, but in places in Asia as well, and probably Africa, where you have, legally You have these protected areas that are supposed to be off limits to invasions, but that in practice, the enforcement is really weak. And I'd say that it's a mixed bag in Brazil. There are some areas that are very well protected and others that are where protection is more sort of a matter of on paper and not particularly real. The Amazon is so huge. The resources that the governments put into protecting it are so scarce. You have, you know, areas of Brazil, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles with just a couple of park guards, for example. In the area that we went into, the protection is really strong because all the rivers flow in one direction. The headwaters are inside the protected area. And so by positioning strategic control points on the rivers at the gateways to the protected area, that protects from any major incursions. The edges of the reserve are still vulnerable to small groups of poachers or loggers coming across the divide, but for the most part, that area is extremely well protected, and that's a big area. But there's a lot more that needs to be done, for sure.
Yes, about teaching the young people. I think that climate change and global warming is real, and it's been real for many years, and it's getting worse and being very rapid. I think we need to integrate it into school curriculum. And like I say, you know, we need to change our way of thinking and change our way of doing things, because look at what we did. You know, for me, it's 3 grandma ago. We were nomadic people, and everything was good then. But now we're in a point where we're threatened throughout the whole world by climate change and global warming, and we really need to act from our living room, from individual, by just doing recycle, reuse, reduce, and also refuse. And we also have energy, you know, alternative source of energy, and we have conservation. But for my people and for Alaska, we need that chance to keep it the way things are, because like for me, we're a caribou people, where everything. A caribou is everything to us. It's our clothing, it's our food, it's our tools, it's our shelter when we used to live in a caribou skin hut. And so we need to get back to where we live based on needs and not on greed. Yes.
Sorry, Sarah and then Margaret. Yeah.
On tourism, like I say, we're on the south side of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's right across the river from Arctic Village. And Fish and Wildlife manage that Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we have a voice there, along with recreation people and hunters and all the other visitors. So that's the way it's operated. But on my own land, we have 1.8 million acres of land to a native village of Vinitai tribal government that include Arctic Village and Vinitai. We do our own tourism, and most of them leave happy because we don't put down pavement or hotel or anything like that. We just have them as one of the community, just like when he been up there. And they learn more, they're more comfortable. Sometimes they go up to Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain. Sometimes they just end up in a tent and come back out, you know, because of weather. And we would like to continue that kind of tourism based on rest, taking a rest and no insurance, because that's what would make us build a hotel pavement for a handicap and elderly access. So that's how we doing it, and we would like to continue to do it, but it's just a lot of work. Not a lot of work, but we the pressure from the outside. Thank you.
Sure. On the Navajo Nation, actually, we have there's a thriving tourism business. Lots of people come to Monument Valley and to Canyon de Chelly and places like that. They're very picturesque and kind of iconic places in the Southwest. However, most of the tourists are not from the United States. I'd say 95% of them are from other countries. And I even asked some of my friends in Flagstaff why they don't visit the Navajo Nation more. And they said, well, the poverty is so apparent that it's just not a very fun place to go. I think so. It just depends on your viewpoint as to whether it's a nice place to visit. I think it is. But one of the problems that we have is, for instance, the Hopi tribe just put in a very fancy new hotel. It's using a lot of water. They had to build, big fancy parking lot and the whole nine yards that you were just talking about, Sarah. And frankly, that takes a lot of water away from communities that are already water stressed. And at first, there was actually a huge controversy between the Navajo and the Hopi about where the water was going to come from, because it's right on the border between the two tribal lands. So those kinds of things, I think, are very deleterious to the welfare of the people. And so, hopefully more of the tourism in the future can be ecotourism. On the other question about what to do about children, I think one of the things that I've discussed most with the students that I work with is how are you going to define what it means to be a Native person as you grow up and you teach your kids? Because all of the things that we use, the iconic things that we use to identify ourselves and our traditions, are disappearing. As I mentioned, people aren't growing their own corn. If you don't grow your own corn, you can't collect your own corn pollen. And corn pollen is central to every single Navajo ceremony. And it's supposed to come from the corn that you grow yourself. For my tribe, I'm from Montana, the Crow tribe. We've lost, we lost our buffalo a long time ago, and we're trying to bring them back. But, these big changes are taking place around us. Our medicinal plants are disappearing. A lot of our ceremonies are going to go away because we don't have the proper resources for them. So we have to start thinking about what it means to be an indigenous person and how we are going to be able to carry on our traditions. And so, some of the things that we've talked about are the fact that Native people are extremely adaptable, and also that we have a strong sense of community and family, extended family relationships, and those things will never go away. So there are things that really do define the way Native people see themselves and live in their surroundings. The other thing is the way you view yourself. As Sarah mentioned, there's a lot of consumer mentality within larger society. Well, if you started to think of everything around you in the world as your relatives, you might not be so anxious to just take everything away from your relatives and leave them wanting. So I think there's a way of using your cultural strengths to survive as Native people, because they've done it before. There's a lot of oral histories about climate change. One of them is in my tribe, the Crow tribe. We were once called Uruge, which means our side. We were farmers along the Missouri River Basin. We grew flint corn. The Hidatsa were part of our tribe. We were all one people. And there was a big famine that I believe took place around the 1300s when the Puebloan peoples moved and abandoned their living places. But what happened, at least in our oral traditions, is there were two sons who were the sons of the tribal leader that were their father, you know, urged them to go out and fast for vision. And one of them fasted and said, you know, we can stay here and we'll survive. And the other one, when he fasted, came back and said, I've, you know, had a vision of a sacred tobacco plant. Anybody who is willing to come and follow me, we will go in search of that plant and we will survive. And those people, the people who went out to look for that tobacco plant, they became the Crow people. Whereas the people who remained behind along the Missouri River, they are the Hidatsa today. So these kinds of stories are very, very universal throughout Native tribes. We know that the Kiowa were once part of our tribe. The Kiowa recognized that they were part of our tribe too. So these histories are there. We've changed who we were in the past because of climate and environmental upheavals, and that was before all of the stresses that we've put on the land now. So this is something very serious about to think about is who are we and what are we going to call ourselves and what are our children going to call themselves? Well, you know, I've actually partnered with the Navajo Nation on a couple of proposals to try to get money for climate change adaptation, and they've gone nowhere. The tribes lobbied Ken Salazar very strongly at the beginning of this year for adaptation funding, unsuccessfully. And part of the reason is, you know, our political climate right now doesn't really allow for a lot of new programs, I believe. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the political climate that doesn't want to address climate change. How ironic. and also the fact that Indian programs over the long haul have been chronically underfunded. And when they do get funded, it's for, you know, a 2 or 3 year program. So it's even hard to keep the tribal programs going, the regular ones that, you know, deal with health care and... and emergency response and things like that. So, and that's the other issue I think part of it is just that these changes have taken place really slowly over time, that it's been slow for people to recognize that they're actually happening and that they've happened in the past and that we just didn't recognize what it was in the past. But, you know, politically marginalized people are politically marginalized people, and they can be a threat to people in nearby communities. For one of the things that the Navajo Nation is trying right now very hard to do is get their allocation of the Colorado River, which is already over-allocated, as you know. So here's one more person or one more group that would like their allocation. So even though the Colorado River is right there on the northern border, and all of these water issues exist on the Navajo Nation, Navajo people can't have access to that water. So that's a big political issue.
I couldn't hear that well.
Okay. as a visual storyteller, the questioner was asking how effective do we think that visual storytelling can be in communicating the message of Indigenous people and their role in this changing world. Is that fair enough?
Yes.
Do you want to go ahead?
Yes, that's very important because here, being here, I feel alone and I feel like there's not enough Indigenous people here, and that we're the one that's been affected the most by climate change because we live close to the earth and we depend on it. And my mother always tell me, like when we were growing up out on the land, We own very little, we carry very little, we have very little food, but we always depend on the environment. And even just to cook my fish or meat to the fire, I can't go and get a steak and not agree with it, get another one, a better one. I had to get the first one. So that's how I grew up. And that goes thing. That goes for the same thing when we hunt and fish. We can only have one hook that can work, and only one. Like our guys, when they get their, when they're young enough to get their gun, all bow and arrow, and they can only target shooting once, and now you know your gun, you don't need no target shooting no more. And that's how close we are to preserving, and like our whole life is like a ceremony to us.
If I could just, from a journalist perspective, I think that the visual components of reporting on Indigenous people are hugely important. Some of the things that you see, because they are Indigenous communities are often in some of the most remote and spectacular places in the world. There's words are often simply inadequate to describe what one is seeing. And I myself have always been drawn to both the visuals and the text in my own reporting. I always carry cameras with me, and I know that I need to use them because so much of what I see is just so mind-bogglingly spectacular, both in terms of the landscape and in terms of the people themselves. So I think it's just hugely important to have a visual component to your work. And for journalists, I think it's, you know, especially in today's world when so many of us are, the job situation is so fluid and so mobile and so unstable that it's crucial for journalists to be able to work across several different platforms of media, visual, text, internet, video, still photography.
And furthermore, money-wise, I grew up, my parents don't have any money, but I had to manage somehow another to graduate from high school. That's the only degree that I have, but I struggle to, even just to do that. So it still is that way. And like I say, 75% of our diet is from the land. And but we still have to live in this two world, and we still have to be accepted in both world, and it's very hard to be an Indigenous person. Thank you.
I think, Martin, would you like to?
I just wanted to mention the visual. I think the visual storytelling is very, very powerful. That's why I brought the pictures that I did today. But I think in some cases it's very difficult because a lot of the people, the traditional people where I work, don't want to be photographed. They don't like photographs. They don't like filming. They're very opposed to it. And it's something, it's a barrier that we're trying to overcome. And in some cases, you know, the young people are very open. So, for instance, I showed you the pictures of the students because it was, they were fine with having their pictures taken. So it's kind of a generational change that's taking place.
to close before going to the plenary in the ballroom, you kindly offered to share with us a send-off of a particular note.
Okay. I have to tell a little short story about this song. It's called Vatsai Ning Vashi Chatsa. That means Caribou Skin Hut Dance. And we used to live in Caribou Skin Hut. And we come in and clockwise and go back out that way. And the door is to the east where the sun rises. And that's how we dance, when we dance. And the flapper of the skin hut open and close you, we welcome you into our home. We're hospitality people, hospitable people, and we always welcome our visitor, welcome you to Miami, who I welcomed you to Florida, Alaska, world, and universe, and see if we can do a better housekeeping. when we're nomadic people, I say maybe three grandma ago for me, the land was good then, and we were well organized, many of us, and healthy. The only thing we used to die of was old age, and now we're dying with so many things, and I just want to sing this song to remind everybody about our home, the whole universe, and what good we can do for it. And this is a prayer, because all our songs is made to a prayer to welcome you and to remind each other about how we can all work together and make a better home. Hey, hey, ha, hey. Thank you.